Welcome back for another helping of oysters, clams, and corpsicles presented by Bolin Media. I am Ross Bolin here with Barrett Dudley to discuss part five of True Detective Night Country. Barrett, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. You know, just experiencing some familial trauma.
Family shit.
Yeah. You know, I just had, it stinks when you got to clean up your dad's brain and guts. Yeah.
That's a tough, you know, it's a tough experience.
It's a rough one. It's a rough one to have to go through. Yeah.
Not super relatable to many of us.
Yeah.
But some of us, perhaps.
I mean, I saw it on the screen, so.
Well, yeah. So you got to deal with it, too.
So it's our nausea.
It's our trauma.
Yeah.
Been a few days since the episode aired on Friday as a result of the Super Bowl being on Sunday, but I rewatched this morning. So shall we dive into part five of HBO's True Detective Night
Country?
Sure,
let's dive in.
So part five opens
crack
with
the ice, if you will.
Yeah.
Fall in, maybe. Maybe we want to fall
let's
in.
Let's fall in.
Yeah.
Let's fall in.
We could spelunk in there if you want to.
Yeah.
It's
little,
a cave.
Little cave diving.
Little yeah.
This one opens with Julia Navarro's body being cremated. That's Trooper Navarro's sister. And this was a very Breaking Bad-esque opening scene, or Better Call Saul if we're trying to make Barrett happy. but like watching the steps in the cremation process.
That's a good insight.
It would have been at least 5 minutes longer if it was done by Vince Gilligan,
but it
still reminded me of like a Breaking Bad opening.
The first thing that I said watching this episode was, I couldn't do that job.
No.
That's a rough job.
Takes a special kind of person.
Yeah.
Deal with the dead and
to just
burn their bodies.
Burn the bodies.
Scrape up the ashes. And
it's weird, too, because I'm very, very, very pro cremation. Like, absolutely do not put me in a wooden box with my body intact. Like, that is...
Yeah, it's a fear of yours.
That is not happening to me, okay?
Yeah.
I'll tell you that much. But this definitely gave me, like, you know, a little bit of a spook about the cremating process as well. But that's okay, you know.
Yeah, I think I want to be...
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Put on, like, an altar, like in Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones, and, like, burn me that way.
Oh,
I don't know
right,
if I want
right,
to be stuffed into
yeah,
one of these
the,
burning
okay.
lockers.
Yes. Like, more like a pyre. You want a pyre.
Yeah.
Right? A funeral
you and I,
pyre.
We're worried about the claustrophobic experience of the afterlife.
Yeah. Even
don't
want
to be in a box.
Even my soul, you know? Like, what if it gets stuck in my body somehow? And
yeah.
Then it, like, yeah. No, like, just tight spaces, boxes. It's all, that's all terrifying.
We want to avoid all that.
Yeah.
The cremator is an Inupiaq woman who is not supposed to be letting Trooper Navarro watch the cremation process, but just asks that Navarro keep it to herself. It is December 31st, New Year's Eve, the 14th day of night. I'm pretty sure we skipped a few days between episode or part four and part five, because this one opens on New Year's Eve, and we were on Christmas Eve prior. No pun intended with the word prior. And that's it for the cold open. It's a nice and easy one, considering what unfolds the rest of this episode. But after the Billie Eilish intro, Danvers is interviewing Otis Heiss, who's going through heroin withdrawals in the same treatment center, I would note, that Julia Navarro was staying. It's the Lighthouse.
The Lighthouse, yep.
Which would not surprise me if Silver Sky Mining Company actually owned that, too. Otis says he didn't know about... He didn't know Raymond Clark before their recent meeting when Clark gave him Annie Kay's jacket, and Clark was asking him how he survived his injuries, which is interesting that Raymond Clark was questioning the only other guy that anybody could find that had similar injuries to the Soul scientist about how he survived. But Otis Heiss does not seem to remember much of his back and forth with Danvers from part four, like where he told Danvers that Clark was going back to the Night Country. But he does remember Raymond Clark saying to him, "She's awake," a bunch of times, and Clark also telling him, "I have to hide. She's out there." I still really don't have a feel for who's awake. Like, that's one of my big question marks that still remains on this show. We fill in a lot of blanks during part five, get a lot of answers that we'll obviously get to on today's show. But I have no idea who Raymond Clark thinks he has to hide from, who he believes has been awoken, who is out there.
So I'm going to I'm trying to do some quick Googling here, but I'm going to excuse me one second. Okay, I'm going to open up the door to some online theorizing that I think could potentially potentially help inform this, because we keep going to the she's awake thing. Who's awake? We don't know.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of dead females.
Right.
Right. Or a couple, anyway. And one of the things that's been tossed around online is that there is an Inuit goddess called Sedna.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of...
I saw somebody tweet this at us, I think.
Okay. So she is the goddess of the sea and the marine animals in Inuit mythology, also known as the mother of the sea or the mistress of the sea. So all that really is now feels very connected and very likely that it could be some allusion to that, if not a direct reference, right? With the Navarros having this urge to walk into the sea, right?
And right.
All of this, a lot of the frozen areas that we're walking on or treading on are on top of the sea. That's where Navarro almost falls in because the ice cracks. And we're digging down into the core of the earth right next to the sea in the caves, and there's frozen whale bones and like all that type of stuff. So, Sedna is a creation myth, and she describes how there's some mythology about how she came to rule over Adlavan, which is the Inuit underworld.
Oh, okay.
So,
just mythological connections there.
Yes. So that seems to be, even if that's not exactly what we're dealing with, it feels like that's like the reference point for what we're dealing with.
Sort of the
At this point, like, it would be weird. I think it would be weird now to go into episode 6 and be like, "Ha ha! It was Sedna the whole time."
Yeah, that right? Likely that not something they're going to do.
So, likely not something that they're going to do. But I feel like that's the
The vibe.
That's the vibe I think we're supposed to be getting, and that they are nodding to, because that seems way too perfect.
And it's too out there. That would be tough to accomplish on screen in a way that was satisfying to viewers. Like, okay, the goddess of the sea, Sedna, woke up and started trouble somehow.
Yeah,
I even saw people going so far as to say, like, Navarro is Sedna. Well, and then her mother never telling her Inupiaq name is going to be connected in there somehow.
Yeah, and I think I saw like some stuff that like Navarro's mother could be kind of like a stand-in for Sedna or something like that, you know, because she's out there and she's, we think, been murdered or has passed somewhere in the tundra, right? So I'm kind of thinking that she is just kind of like a fill-in for like these dead women, Mother Earth, kind of the sea goddesses, this whole kind of thing.
Mother Earth was the idea that I like, the concept that I kept running back into in my head. Like, okay, it's like an analogy, right?
Yeah.
I don't think this is something we're going to get a hard answer to. Like, by the end of part 6, I don't expect to understand who's awake.
Who's awake.
I think that's just going to be one of those things, you know what I mean, that you kind of have to look into if you want more.
Yeah.
And I think those answers are probably pretty solid. I don't know that we're going to get better than that.
Yeah.
Otis also tells Danvers about how he got his injuries, that 30 years ago there was a cave-in, men died trapped in the ice, those who survived the cave collapse ran out, including himself, there was a blizzard, then Otis heard something screaming, howling, the other men started following the sound, Otis tried to go after them, and then nothing. He woke up in the hospital, his eyes burned, his ears gone to shit. So a very similar circumstance to what occurred with the Salal scientists or whatever, and you know, that later gets described as a weather event in this episode. But Danvers takes out a map and tries to make Otis point to the place where the cave-in occurred. He points it out, but he tells her she can't go out there alone. It's too dangerous. The ice is like crawling on thin glass, he says. But Danvers says he is going to take them out there, but Otis implies he can't do that unless she brings him heroin, gets him his fix, right? Which you had to have known Danvers was probably going to do. You're not really a true detective if you haven't rifled through the evidence room to score hard drugs for occasional
hard drugs.
Like
Rust did it in
season 1. Yeah. So it turns out the cave is on Silver Sky Mining property. They own the entire region. Shocker. When Danvers and Navarro go out there solo, the entryway has been blown shut. Looks like with dynamite or something. Somebody really didn't want anybody going out there, Barrett. And Navarro's very upset by this dead end, if you will. Peter Pryor's wife, Kayla, kicks him out of his house. No surprise there. So Peter goes by his dad's place, and as he's like about to approach and ask him if he can crash there, He hears him through the window singing a really depressing song with his guitar, which then, first of all, I think that song was written for this show because I was Googling the lyrics. Nothing. Nothing except True Detective Night Country kicks back. But this kicks off a montage of Leah and her girlfriend participating in a protest of the mines as we hear Hank singing in the background. And at least at the beginning, it's Hank. I don't know if they switched to like a legit singer there. If not, Hank has some pipes. But the cops are rolling out there to handle the potential conflict at the protest.
He's giving big Billy Bob Thornton vibes. Bob Thornton has like his own band and is like a great guitar player and musician and all that stuff on the side. I think John Hawks might be like very similar. I'm willing to bet that John Hawks played the guitar, sang that song for real. That was all him.
Oh, he crushed it then.
Natural talent and ability there. And if he's like suddenly popping up on stage at South by Southwest in a few weeks, like touring with his new band called like the Dead Ice Ghosts or whatever, like I won't be that surprised.
Major Johnny Cash vibes too.
Yes, yes, yes. Very Johnny Cash-esque.
What's the actor's name?
John Hawks. And John I just want to say, we'll obviously touch on all of his scenes. But finally, they gave it, like, finally in this episode, it was like, okay, this is why they got John Hawks. Because up until now, it's like, we're wasting this guy.
Yeah.
This could have been any Tom, Dick, or Harry off the street playing this role. And this had all the John Hawks scenes in it this episode. So that, kind of a shame that they didn't pepper these in a little bit more, but he finally got to do his thing.
Yeah. He also got my wife to start watching Deadwood, and John Hawks is in there too.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, he's in all kinds of stuff. But HBO family, dude.
I'm guessing he plays a bad guy.
No, he's a good guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's actually a good guy in both of the other HBO things. I know. Eastbound and Down, he's a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then Deadwood, he's a good guy. But he dominates this role on True Detective Night Country. So the montage plays out nicely. You see like police clashing with the protesters. Then we kind of flash to Peter calling his dad and asking if he can crash with him. He's like outside already, but he tells him he's 5 minutes away. I guess just giving himself a minute and letting his dad recover from the Johnny Cash song.
Well, he looks like he's about to just go right in there.
Yeah.
And then he sees his dad playing the song, like having himself some a little bit of me time.
A little moment.
And he's like, I better call ahead.
Yeah. He's still grieving the Russian mail order bride that wasn't.
Yeah.
So back to the protest, things have gotten really bad by the time Navarro rolls in wearing full riot gear. Protesters are chanting land back, water back, and Navarro sees the ghost of Annie Kay lingering in the crowd.
They're also chanting, we were here first, they're going to be here when you're gone, something like that.
They got a few different little chants they're doing. You know, usually protesters come with at least a few that they can chunk out there, but... ghost of Annie Kay lingering in the crowd, which kind of, this gets played up a lot throughout the episode, but like Leah says, all the things Annie Kay fought for, they're still going on.
Mm-hmm.
Then a cop grabs Julia, Danvers's stepdaughter, out of the crowd from behind and starts beating her ass, like seemingly for no reason. It's almost like she just picked a random person.
Yeah.
Julia's girlfriend, Sherry, we get her name, Sherry, she doesn't do shit. She runs off.
She's not a
bottom bitch. And Navarro busts in and keeps this cop from like hospitalizing Julia in all likelihood. And then Navarro beats the shit out of that cop that attacked Julia in front of everyone. It's not like she like, let's go over here and talk. Just right there in front of all the protesters, cop on cop.
Mm-hmm.
So Navarro calls Danvers to tell her, you know, hey, I've got your daughter out here at this protest. And Danvers tells her to take Julia and have her locked up to, like, teach her a lesson. Like, here, are, you know, this is the kind of world you're delving into.
Mm-hmm.
Danvers then asks Peter Pryor if he knew Julia was going to the protest. He says no, tells Danvers that he got kicked out of his house. And she asks him if he needs a place to stay, which fortunately, at least at this point, he was smart enough to turn her down and point blank says, like, that would put me on the fast track to divorce. But then he shows her the file that proves the LLC which paid the grants that fund Salal Station trace back to Tuttle United, who does business with Norbank Securities, which is a founding partner of Silver Sky Mining. Short version of that is this is all connected, right?
Yeah, the short version is that Silver Sky is funding Salal.
Yeah, as Danvers puts it, the mine bankrolls Salal, then Salal pushes out bogus pollution numbers for them.
Yeah, this is it's diminishing returns for me with the wedging in of the Tuttle. I could have done without it. I didn't need the tie.
I don't think it could be any name. I don't think you have to take it as like, you know, ooh, the big conspiracy from season one.
It's
I'm
like
with
just
you.
Just a nod for the heads.
Yeah, because it really makes it confusing if you try to think about it in those terms. Like, okay, Tuttle United, which was also tied
well, it clearly
into
doesn't,
season
it doesn't
one.
Matter.
No, I think Tuttle like, United is basically like a stand-in for evil. This is like the evil backing, right? That's kind of it. You don't have to take it further than that. Danvers then has to go meet with Kate McKintrick, the woman who seemingly runs the mining company and is the town big shot, and Captain Connolly, who she's been banging, about these protests. And Silver Sky Mining, when she shows up, has a pretty impressive office building with like private security. They definitely wanted us to see like how state of the art that place is comparative to the rest of the town, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll preface this by saying I am going to nitpick this episode a little bit. I also have plenty of praise for it.
Yeah.
But there are just some there you know, as we have been dissecting this show, and so I'm going to keep doing it. There just have been little things with the writing and the storytelling that have just felt like missed to me. And so I don't like the fact that suddenly it's dropped on us. And maybe I'm just an idiot. Maybe I was supposed to pick up on this four episodes ago. But like, Kate McKintrick is the mine. She like owns the damn mining company.
Yeah.
That wasn't an important note for us when we meet her at the ice rink.
I don't think they wanted to give it to us up front.
But they should have. That would have been very like that's obvious information. You don't think the police would have been talking about... We got it. Like this is they would have noted that Kate is also the owner of the mine or the CEO of the mine or whatever. And instead, they like pitch her to us as like she's just a good old townswoman that loves the town and owns the ice rink.
Well, at that point, the mine didn't mean shit to us. Like we weren't worried about the mine.
Exactly,
we were just worried about the scientists.
Which is why it wouldn't have been like it's not like they would have been tipping us off by being like.
What I'm saying is, I don't think they had a reason to bring it up,
but they didn't have a reason not to. Like that she's a major player.
Yeah, but I think they wanted us leaving that scene with Danvers and her at the ice rink asking like, "Wait, who is that woman?" Like I think that's where they wanted us to be. I don't think they wanted us to be like, "Oh, that's Kate McKintrick, big shot in the town who runs the mining company and also has the ice skating rink." Like, you know what? She's supposed to be kind of like a questionable figure in the background.
Yeah.
Until we get this confirmation, cuz to your point, this is supposed to serve as like an eye-opening moment where you're like, oh, shit, this woman is pulling all these strings. She's got this connection with Connolly. Like, Connolly is clearly doing stuff for her, too.
Right.
She kind of runs everything. Like, I don't think you're supposed to have that moment until right here. Before that, it's all just like, you know, theorizing.
Okay. All right.
But, yeah, so Kate McKintrick shows Danvers security camera footage from 9:15 that morning during the lead up to the protest, which Kate calls a riot, of Danvers and Navarro standing outside the former entrance to the caves. The question there is, why does Silver Sky Mining have a random camera pointed at this exact spot that they're still monitoring?
Yeah, it's pretty strange.
Even after the cave has been blown closed, mm-hmm. right? That is the question. Kate McKintrick also tells Danvers that the good news is this isn't a murder case after all. And then Connolly chimes in that forensics came back from Anchorage. Remember, they took all the corpsicle up to Anchorage. And they found that it was a weather event.
Yeah.
It was a slab avalanche. They're sudden and move at 100 miles an hour. Now, this is obviously bullshit. Like, you're off the top. You're supposed to know this is a lie. Why the fuck would they take off all their clothes and stack them neatly in a pile and put their shoes on top?
Yeah.
You know what? It doesn't add up at all.
Yeah, it's also very... Issa Lopez has been very open about this in interviews and everything about how there's a lot of... And she's made lots of references to the Dyatlov Pass pass incident, which we have mentioned loosely here on the pod as well. But this is just another scene that like very clearly like evokes that
yes.
whole story occurrence. Like because that's what it... That's essentially what history has chalked that up to.
Yeah.
Is a... crazy ass like weather event.
And it's almost like her saying like that's also not true.
Right, exactly. Right? Yeah. It does kind of feel like that.
Really makes you wonder about the Dyatlov Pass situation and if that's just a cover up, right?
Yeah.
So when Danvers calls out the mine bankrolling Salal, McKintrick just like makes up some bullshit. She's like not really thrown by that at all. Then Connolly and Danvers are left alone. And Connolly brings up the William Wheeler murder-suicide case, implying that he knows Danvers and Navarro killed Wheeler, and says the Salal case is closed. So it's a cover-up, Barrett. Like, Connolly is in cahoots with McKintrick and Silver Sky Mining, and they're all covering it up, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, at the very least, he's saying, for whatever reason, you know, I think from Danvers' side right here, you know, it's not necessarily that Connolly is fully in on the
he may not know why he's doing what he's
right,
doing,
but he's ending this case. This is closed and shut, and don't mess with it. And here's the blackmail, right?
Yeah,
So it could just be because he doesn't want this on his hands. He doesn't want this mess. We know he's got the campaign for political office next year. Like, he's not trying to get tied up into this whole big, like, murder, crazy, mind, Salal, like, bullshit.
So Connolly's not necessarily, like, a mastermind.
Not for Danvers in this moment, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Obviously, we figure out that he is way more tied into it. But, yeah.
Next, McKintrick and Hank Pryor meet privately in Kate's car. She tells Hank that Danvers is not going to let this go, that Danvers is looking for the location of the Cowtalk murder. She says point blank, she can't find that cave. She's basically asking Hank to kill Otis Heiss so he can't take Danvers to the cave. And Hank says, I did something for you. You promised me chief of police in exchange, and you broke your promise. And Kate says she couldn't have known Danvers was going to be exiled here. She had no control over that, but things are different now. This time is different. You do this, and the job is yours, she says. And Hank gets out of the car. So at this point, you know, we've had a lot of questions about Hank.
I'm not a killer.
About his storyline. Yeah. Really adamant that he wasn't a killer right before doing a very vicious killing. But this is our pretty much confirmation. I would take it like similar to Connolly, like this guy is just under control of the mind, right? Like he's willing to do stuff for money that is illegal at the behest of Kate McKintrick and the mining people. And that he had some tie-in to Annie K, but we don't know what it is at this point in the episode. Yeah. We just know he was involved.
He's in the pocket of big mining, man. That's what's happening here.
Yeah.
He's under the thumb.
Yep. So he gets out of the car, and I guess this was basically the point in the episode where I have the realization, like, Annie K was killed in these caves, owned by Silver Sky Mining, likely after discovering something she was not supposed to find related to the pollution of the water. Clark probably killed her there when he found her and realized she'd been using him, right? And then McKintrick has Hank Pryor move her body to cover it all up and avoid problems for Silver Sky Mining. Mm-hmm. Pretty sure that's where we're at in terms of Annie K.
Feels right.
Silver Sky, this cave situation, and that's that. Let's move on to the second half. But first, today's episode is brought to you by you, or at least it could be, should be, if you subscribe on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles every week during this season of Night Country, in addition to our public sponsor-based episodes like this one. Barrett and I record and release an additional ad-free premium episode available exclusively to our supporters on Patreon, driven by hotline calls from our listeners who call in with questions, theories, and takes, which we respond to on the show. So on our public show, we cover what happens on each episode and discuss. Then on Patreon each week, we dive deeper, harder, and further with insights from listeners as well. It's just $5 to officially join the Clam Fam on Patreon, and when you do so, in addition to all of our ad-free bonus coverage of Night Country, you'll gain access to hundreds of hours of exclusive content, including our entire companion podcast for every episode of The Sopranos, friendly to first-timers and rewatchers, as well as our bonus hotline call-driven coverage for Season 1 of House of the Dragon, Season 2 of The White Lotus, the final season of Succession, The Last of Us, Season 1, Season 1 of Silo, and Season 2 of Foundation, plus
Who Built the Silo?
A companion podcast for like 15 different classic movies in the form of our movie club there on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. So go today and subscribe to support our show and receive so much more OCC in return. Just $5 to join the Clam Fam. And if you want to go above and beyond and also gain access to the exclusive hotline number and our Discord server, it's $10 to join the Mollusk Militia tier. Go to patreon.com/oystersclamscockles today to support our show and get even more of our show in exchange. So next, we see Navarro doing laundry, and there's like someone's hair in her washing machine. Like there's a person in there. Mm. So she like starts digging for it, but then Peter Pryor's wife walks up and asks if she's okay. Just like it was the only like horror-esque moment of this episode, really, right? Yeah. Compared to like the three or four that we got last week.
Okay.
So, so Kavik busts in with his friend Kenny and immediately hands Navarro the stone with the spiral on it that she left at his place last episode. We had a lot of questions about this and Kavik. We've been on Kavik watch all season. Kenny says his grandpa told him to walk away whenever he saw one of those stones. Quote, people would leave them as a warning for hunters, places where the ice would swallow them whole. So all referring to these underground ice caves, right? Kenny also says he and his friends, when they were kids, would sometimes intentionally crack the ice and go down into the caves. And his grandma was really pissed off when she found out. She said the night country was going to take us. So that's the name of the show.
That is
do
the
whole
of
the Leonardo
show.
DiCaprio yeah. whistling and pointing thing, if you would like.
Kenny?
Yeah. They killed Kenny.
Come on, Kenny.
Navarro busts into Danvers' office and tells her all they have to do to get into the caves is find the highest point and crack in. And Danvers has to tell her that the case has been shut down, that it was a freak weather event, and Connelly is shutting them down. Plus, most importantly, Connelly knows about Wheeler and has that to hold over their heads, right? So Navarro does not actually want to let it go, though. She tells Danvers it's her turn to carry Annie Kay's death every day. You're leaving her alone in that cave in the dark. You. She's yours now. And then Navarro goes and lets Leah out of jail to spite Danvers mm-hmm. even further. It's a very loose system they've got here in this jail.
Well,
you can just take people out whenever.
I don't think she was ever officially booked is the feeling I got.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there might have been some false imprisonment going on there.
A little kidnapping.
Just skosh.
Hank goes and tells Peter Pryor about the time that Peter was 9 years old and he fell through the ice and the current took him and Hank had to break through the ice with an axe and pull him out. And we even get like a little flashback. We see some of the hacking.
Yeah,
you know?
John Hawk's baller scene number two.
Yes, yeah. No, he owns this.
And again, this is why you get John Hawks, is to sit down and deliver like a stirring monologue like this where you're like, I don't know about this guy. What is he talking about? Is this supposed to be spooky? Is it eerie? Is it heartfelt?
Right.
Is
this a little bit of all that?
Is this a real dad moment? Is it a threat? Like, what the shit is like? And that's why you get a guy like John Hawks.
Yeah. First watch, I took it as like a try to remember me as a good dad because I'm gonna die. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm going off on a mission that I can't tell you about.
Sure, sure. And very much like a I loved you, son. I do.
Yes.
I do. And I did like have good intentions as a father.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a real dad in here somewhere.
Yeah. It was basically like hey, remember that time I saved your life?
Yeah. But that,
just a little reminder. I saved your life because daddy's about to go do some bad shit.
I really loved the cut scene to him smashing through the ice. Dark story, man. I mean, the guy like,
hell yeah. That'd be terrifying.
You hear stories about this, right? Where somebody like slips through and then they're under the ice.
Yeah, and the hole they fell through is like frozen over immediately.
And you can't get back up because the water's flowing. So there's really scary stuff here. And I thought the visual of him like pickaxing the ice to save his son was pretty moving.
There's another show I watched recently where something like this happens in season 3 of The Great. That's all I'll say. Spoilers.
No spoilers.
So next we see Navarro out on the ice with Rose Aganaw. Hacking away at the ground, creating a hole so Navarro can put her sister's ashes into the ocean. Now, this is another really, really weird Rose Aganaw scene.
As soon as this scene starts, I was like, oh my God, Ross is right.
Right? She's not real.
But then she's throwing the bag to Navarro and shit, and I'm like, I don't know.
I think it's going to be one of those things where, like, you know when you watch the movie Fight Club? Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Fight Club.
No.
The whole time, you're like, you're completely unaware that Brad Pitt is not there.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they show you this flashback to all the scenes that you thought Brad Pitt was in, and it's just the one guy.
They are, at the very least, this is full-on a concerted press to make you not know if Rose Aganaw is...
Yeah,
To not have a clue.
Yes.
Because she just pops up. We don't even see her go get Rose.
Right.
They're just off together on this mission, which is very sus.
And again, it's always Navarro.
And it's always with Navarro. She's the only person that has actually like interacted with Rose that we've seen so far.
Yeah.
And so, all of that is definitely... And this thing right here, like where she tosses the bag, could all be very just easily written as like that was all in Navarro's mind. She laid down on the ice on her own. She crawled back up. This was all in her head, helping her clear the patch of ice that had broken there, right? And then I'm just going to jump forward real quick because then there's another note where She tells Peter Pryor after he cleans up to go take this to Rose Aganall.
Yeah.
And so I'm leaning your way here. I think he's going to get out there and be like, there's nobody named Rose Aganall. There's nobody here.
Right.
But
who knows what he's going to find out
and
there?
Who knows
man.
What he's going to find out there? But if he or he'll find her and she'll help him clean it up. But it feels like we're going your way.
In the other direction.
Because that scene opening with Navarro, just cutting to Navarro out in the middle of nowhere on top of an ice cave with Rose Aganall, that was pretty.
Well, dude, Rose is an older woman. Navarro is larger, more fit. Why the fuck would you just stand there and watch this woman cut the hole? Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, physically, it doesn't make sense. So, yeah, I mean, this was another huge red flag where I was just like, what is happening with this Rose character? Like,
also, Issa Lopez retweeted our video.
Oh, yeah, she did.
Talking about Rose Aganall's suspect existence.
Yeah, yeah. Which makes you think. Right? She's trying to get more people, like, kind of thinking in that direction. But I honestly, the retweet is the only thing keeping me thinking, like, okay, this might be like a...
Oh, like maybe she's head faking in the
yeah,
other...
Yeah, like a big head fake. And then it turns out we're all supposed to be in the headspace I'm in, mm-hmm. and it's supposed to be a shock when she actually is real. But I'm still...
Yeah.
If you combine the scenes, like the Christmas Eve scene mm-hmm. and this ice cutting scene,
yeah.
bro, this woman is a ghost
yeah.
that is helping Evangeline Navarro. So Navarro pours the ashes into the hole that Rose... air quotes, created. And then she hears someone calling her name through the wind. Evangeline, listen. So she starts to walk toward the voice, then suddenly flashes again back to her time in the service with that same, like, overturned, like, truck that's clearly hit a bomb or whatever. And then, like, bam, we're back in the present. The ice is cracking, starting to go beneath her feet. She lies down, crawls on the ice at the instruction of Rose Aganall. Then Rose pulls her to safety, and Rose asks, what the fuck were you doing walking into the sea like that? I called you back. Didn't you hear me? Again, none of that follow-up changes anything about the fact that, like, Rose might not have been there at
yeah,
all.
Yeah, totally. That very much could all exist in Navarro's
head, yeah.
head or she's or this is
or
a ghost.
Or it's a spirit.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So Danvers goes and visits Leah at Peter Pryor's house, and Leah tells her there have been 9 stillbirths in the village in the past 3 months, that everything Annie K fought for is still happening. Which that was a shocking number to hear thrown out. Like, we knew there wasn't just the one stillbirth. Like, we knew there had been multiple, but mm-hmm. 9 in 3 months is pretty damning evidence that something has gone horribly wrong with the water situation, right? So, also, Peter Pryor is tailing Danvers. I'm sorry, Hank Pryor is yep, tailing yep. Danvers everywhere to get to Otis Heiss. So he's just, like, following her around.
Yeah. Good scene earlier with Leah and Peter Pryor.
Where Peter drops her a Pepsi.
Yeah, yeah, and this was going to be my kind of other back half note about just like some of the things that I just really strongly feel should have been base laid earlier in the season so that they weren't lingering questions in my mind, and we finally got a little bit of answers here. But remember how we kept talking about like what is the connection? How are the Pryors and the Danvers
so close?
So close and so linked. Why are they just like back and forth at each other's house even though they don't like each other? What is going on with the
right.
Pete and
Leah?
Kayla is his wife.
Oh yeah, yeah, Kayla.
Kayla relationship where they like so. Laura caught on to this before this episode, but she had suggested to me that what had happened was Pete and Kayla are really young. Really, really young.
Right.
Like, they're, like, early 20s, probably. Like,
right.
they probably got pregnant in high school, decided to keep the baby, but it was a question, got married because of the baby.
Right.
And, like, that later, at some point in this episode, I think during this whole tailing scene when Hank meets with, at some point, he's telling somebody, maybe it was even Kate McKintrick in the car, he's like, nobody should have to get married that young.
Yeah, it was
right?
in the car.
So he finally nods to that. So Leah and Peter Pryor are much closer in age than we're probably thinking.
Yeah.
I think he babysat for her.
Yeah.
There's just some story I feel like they could have filled in a little bit earlier or spent a little bit more time on to just kind of give us the, just to have the kind of the lay of the land a little bit, so that we're not stuck asking those questions.
So you think giving us more meaningful substance to these relationships earlier in the season would have helped some of those conversations we see unfold hold more water? Like, they would have been more meaningful.
Yeah. And just and alleviate some of the kind of like, well, we don't know what's happening. They're not building this, like, knowing the characters and their relationships to one another. And
got
like,
you. Yeah.
I think could have helped the earlier episodes a little bit, because I'm finally now, with one episode to go, kind of like understanding
a lot of what you saw earlier.
The priors and the Danvers connection, why that young relationship is as strained as it is.
Yeah.
How Peter is so connected and friendly with Danvers' daughter, Leah, and that makes it even more, that connects it even more, that, like, Peter is kind of a surrogate son for Danvers as well.
Right. And it's not, she's not trying to, you know, bang him, like I thought. Yeah.
But going forward, the line that I wanted to point to in that Leah-Peter Pryor conversation is when she says that she's not good with people that she cares about.
Right.
So we'll put a pin in that when we talk about Danvers and Jodie Foster later.
Yeah.
But so, yeah.
No, I think, like, the two camps were people like you who were like, I don't want to have to be asking so many questions after every episode. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like I'm being left in the dark and you're intentionally withholding information.
Yeah.
And then there was my camp, which was, for whatever reason, was really trusting with the way the story was unfolding. Like, I just felt like they were giving us pieces to later fill in the gaps. Like, it wasn't bothering me nearly as much. And I don't know what the hell, because I'm usually not that trusting, frankly. So I don't really know how that happened. But that does seem to be the way we ended up with this show and the audience that's watching it. So Danvers goes and visits Innes' version of, like, a funeral parlor where the Undertaker is storing all these bodies, because it'll be another 3 months before they can dig any graves because it's so frozen, right? So Liz Danvers sees all the stillborn coffins as confirmation that Leah is not wrong.
Yeah.
Like, this has actually occurred. So Danvers says, fuck all this, goes into the evidence room, gets some heroin for Otis Heiss, and then on her way out, sees Hank is, like, literally walking behind her. Like, he's not very subtle, this
no,
guy.
He's not.
Not even whistling or anything to make it seem, like, inconspicuous. He's just fucking walking behind
her. Just creepily walking behind her.
So she, like, ignores him. You can tell there's a lot of history between Liz and Hank, and she kind of just ignores him, calls Peter into her office, tells him to close the door, asks him who he talked to about Wheeler, because Connolly knows about Wheeler, and as she puts it, because Hank knows about Wheeler. So she has made the assumption that Hank Pryor somehow found out about the Wheeler case and how it unfolded, and he took that to Connolly.
Yeah.
So this was hard for me, like, in real time watching it, and I was like, I don't
understand. A lot of brain work here, yeah.
It took me, what is happening? I shouldn't have taken that second edible. but apparently, Hank broke into Peter's computer.
Yes.
And looked at what Peter had been looking into regarding Wheeler.
Yep.
So I guess Peter had been, like, he'd really gathered a substantial amount of evidence in terms of the Wheeler case.
Yeah.
And, like, it was easy for Hank to, like, go through what he had put together and see.
Yeah. He has that conversation with Danvers early in the season. She tells him that it was the Wheeler case that broke the relationship between her and Navarro.
But she won't give a real
doesn't really
won't
give him
real
the
answers.
Whole thing. He can tell that she's kind of, like, balking at that and not telling her the full story.
Yeah.
So he can't let it go. And he keeps investigating that case.
Okay. Yeah. That all tracks.
What he finds out is that they had that they did not know that Wheeler was left-handed.
Right.
And the bullet hole in his head, which is supposed to be a suicide, is on his right temple. So he did that with his right hand, because they faked it instead of his left hand.
Dude.
And so they had to go in, and all the photography of the deceased victim, of his wife, they had to flip so that it looked like he was abusing her with his right hand and had been committing his crimes with his right hand, not his left.
Because he would have shot himself
because
with his right
shot
hand.
Him.
Dude,
because,
thank you.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. Because, like, I've got full notes here, man. let me just walk you through what I've got. Next, we have a bizarre scene where Danvers demands Peter question her, ask her questions, right? And as a result of this back and forth, we find out Danvers and Navarro visited the Wheeler household 10 times, so they had been out there a bunch, that Wheeler was left-handed, and I was like, okay, noted. but all the blows on the deceased were right to left. And I was like, well, what? Because like right, because that, if you're right-handed and you're hitting me in the face, mm-hmm. that is right to left.
Right.
So why would, but then Peter shows she had a birthmark on the left side of her face. But
yeah, so the way that he figures out that they had flipped all of the photos is because he pulls up a high school yearbook photo, sees where her birthmark is, and then sees that it's on the other side in all of the photos.
Right, so a left-handed guy wouldn't have been raining down blows with his right. That doesn't make any sense. Exactly. So clearly they flipped the photos. Yeah. Thank you. Now I'm here.
Yeah, now I'm here with everyone else. So he's doing all of the legwork, the detective work to figure
Damn,
out.
Damn, he's good.
Yeah. That they likely staged the suicide,
okay,
and then changed all of the evidence to fit the narrative that he had killed himself.
Man, ballsy move! Yeah. Just flipping photos, fucking A.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
that's when she finally like tells him like, you got to know when to stop asking the fucking questions.
Yeah, it says everything else. The ballistic and forensics report, they were lost in the flood.
Yeah,
there was no other way for people to go and figure this out, right?
Yeah.
And then Peter asks, did you and Navarro shoot William Wheeler and make it look like a suicide? And Danvers' response is, you see, smart as you are, you need to learn when to stop asking questions. And this is an example of a scene where I didn't think Jodie Foster fully sold some of these lines. It's been strange because there are scenes where I'm like, okay, yeah, she's completely in character. And mm-hmm. other scenes where I'm like, it feels like she just went and read that line again off screen, like memorized it,
mm-hmm.
and then shot the scene like without any real buy-in. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Look, I haven't rubbed on a lot of the things that some of y'all have,
but
with Jodie Foster, I keep being like, ugh. You're getting out-acted by all these fucking people I've never even heard of before.
So, okay. So, I think that Jodie Foster is really, really strong in the last 25 minutes or 20 minutes of this episode.
Yep.
Basically, everything after this.
Yeah.
And what I started thinking about, and especially because we got all the amazing John Hawkes scenes in this episode, and one of the things that I had read or heard early is that Jodie Foster liked the idea of this role and liked taking this role because she thought it would be fun to play an asshole.
Okay.
To play a kind, like we talked about earlier.
Somebody
like
that rubs you the wrong
more
way.
More of an anti-hero, right?
Yeah.
But John Hawkes, who is a classic character villain actor, like eats that shit up, chews it up, spits it out. Built for that role.
Different for her.
Jodie Foster usually plays a good guy.
Yeah.
And so when we open this, that's why I wanted to keep that line that Leah says, like, Danvers is bad with people that she cares about. Because once we open the door, once we kind of like crack the veil that Danvers does care and is good and has the people's is making the right call here. She sees the stillborn babies in the small coffins. It like impacts her too much. She has to do something. She can't carry the Annie Kay case. She cares about Leah. She doesn't want Leah to die. Pete is her surrogate son.
Yeah.
Fuck your dad because he's a bad dude. Like,
yep.
come in and stay in my back house, which, by the way, has no AC or heat and is just a tiny little wooden shack, so you might freeze to death out there. Sorry
legit
about that.
Shack, yeah.
but, like, once she gets to start being, like, a better person and, like, get in touch with that emotion, I feel like that's her skill, like, her performance changes in a way that suits her much better. So that's all I'm coming around on is that like Jodie Foster doesn't typically play this role. It's one of the reasons why she was so interested in it. And I'm just not and I think that was a challenge for her, probably why she wanted, you know, probably one of the reasons that she was drawn to it. But I think that the results are mixed.
It also may be that just Danvers is a straight up very awkward person when it comes to those moments of empathy or emotion. And Jodie's playing it that way intentionally and me watching it. I'm not comfortable with the awkwardness.
That's fair too.
Like I really think that might be
a layer of that. She is very, very awkward in a lot of the, anytime something gets a little too close to emotion, whether she's talking to Leah or Navarro or whoever, she definitely like kind of like recedes into herself.
Yeah,
a
she has
bit.
A strange reaction, that's what makes me kind of like cringe a little bit. And I think that might be it. We're kind of hitting the nail on the head here. So, she gives Pete a key to the shack in the backyard of her house, which didn't flag for me at all until we see him enter it. And like you were saying, I was like, God damn,
I was offended by this. I was like, okay, she's finally making like this nice gesture. Pete, you're gonna come stay with me. I got this ADU in the back. It's going to be fine. Like, I got it. And then it's like a little Santa's workshop back there.
Yeah.
Like, it barely has windows. It's like 10 feet by 10 feet. No AC, no climate. It's not even climate controlled. What's this guy supposed to do back there?
Didn't look like it was insulated. I really don't understand.
I didn't see a bed. Right. He sits down in a lawn chair. Yeah.
Well, look, he clearly wasn't going to stay in her house, right? And she had to give him somewhere to go. It was basically like her saying, like, look, now that we've found out your dad broke into your computer,
yeah,
your dad is a bad guy.
Right.
You cannot stay with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is the only other option I've got. This is the shack.
Can't she, like, give him the couch at least?
God,
give a guy a couch?
Yeah, I don't know, bro. That was rough, though. That's not where I want to spend the night.
It's like negative 10 degrees outside,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, it just seems unsafe. Navarro goes and cuddles with Kavik. She makes him Little Spoon, but no power riding. I just wanted to make a note of that scene. It was sweet. Then Danvers goes and gets Otis Heiss, tells him she got him his heroin medicine, and he's going to guide them through that cave. Which, look, no offense to heroin junkies, I'm not really looking to rely on for my personal safety in a perilous cave exploration situation just some dude who's hopped up on H. Like, that. I get it. They need somebody to guide them. He's an addict, so he's better off when he's juiced up than when he's going through withdrawals. But I'm looking at this guy and going, there's no fucking way I'm following that dude through a cave.
Yeah.
There's just no fucking way. I'm sorry.
Ross, he's got to get well, man.
Yeah, you know. Well, she's getting him well.
He's got to get well.
She got him the good shit out the evidence locker.
I don't know. This is a trope that I feel like we see in TV and
yeah.
movies quite a bit.
Yeah.
Is that, like, functioning heroin addicts are basically, like, only themselves and functioning when they have their fix, right?
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, that's the case with hardcore addiction in general, not just heroin. I think when, you know, you've got hard alcoholics, they can't do shit
without a little bit of,
unless it's in them,
a little bit of juice.
Like,
yeah.
They get the shakes, they're fucking sweating and miserable and puking, like, they get sick. Heroin addicts even more so.
Right.
So I get that part of it, but, like, the man's had his eyes blasted out and by whatever the fuck he experienced out there.
He's
like,
a real, he's a creature.
Yeah.
He's a creature of the night country, I would say.
It's like getting Gollum to lead you to Mordor. You know what I mean? Just like, couldn't find a better guide?
There was a scene that reminded me of Gollum.
Yeah,
there.
Dude.
Like, I was like, oh, man, they should have gotten Andy Serkis to play this. But Andy Serkis is not, like, gaunt and, you know, kind of withered away.
He doesn't look rough enough.
He doesn't look rough enough. This dude is.
Yeah, he's been through, he's seen some shit.
He has seen some shit. That is true.
So Danvers calls Navarro and tells her to meet at Danvers' house, that they're going to go to where Annie died. And, you know, we get the sweet scene with Navarro telling Kavik bye. And he's like, just come back. Like, yeah. I love that he's like, I'm not even going to try to talk you out of this. Mm-hmm. Because I know you're going anyway. Like, you could hear that conversation playing out in your mind without it having to happen on screen, which I appreciate. At Danvers' house, Otis, very important here, Otis does point on the map for Danvers the highest point of the cave formation where they will get in, right? Very important, because he's about to get shot in the head. Then he goes and freebases heroin in her bathroom. On the way to Danvers' place, Navarro sees a little girl in the street who stops and points at her car. And then we see flashes of scientist Lund pointing, the ghost chick at Wheeler's pointing, and Navarro's mother pointing. Now, we're still not exactly sure how all this pointing is going to come into play in the end, but I fucking guarantee you somebody in the season finale is fucking pointing.
Yeah, so
obviously.
Yeah, this is all tying into, for me, I think at the moment, it's tying into Navarro's connection with the spirit world.
Yeah.
And also maybe a little bit of the she and the Sedna thing as well. Because all these people seem to be pointing at Navarro.
Right.
Like, it's you.
Yeah.
And whatever that means, but you, something's up with you.
Yes.
Because we're pointing at you.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the direction that I think this is headed.
Yeah, it's the direction they're pointing. It's a very good note. No, I mean, every single one of them pointing at her.
Yeah.
Not at something else, right? Travis Cole points at something else.
Right.
But that's, Navarro's not in that scene.
No. Slightly different point.
Yeah, yeah. So suddenly Hank Pryor walks into Danvers' place, and at first I was like, oh, okay. But remember, these people don't lock the doors because of polar bears. Apparently you have to have the doors unlocked in case a polar bear comes in so you can get out real fast.
Okay.
That's like, I'm serious. This is like a thing in Alaska.
Damn.
So yeah,
that's tight.
Prior, Hank walks in and tells Danvers that at the behest of Connolly, he is going to take the engineer junkie Otis Heiss. Now, at first I was like, aha, Connolly, you bastard. Mm. I think he made that part up. I don't think he spoke to Connolly. Mm. I think he's just using that as an excuse. So, because then Liz is like, oh, yeah, okay, sure. I'll just call Connolly right up. And when she goes for her phone, Hank grabs her phone and puts his hand on his gun.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he's not going to let her check. And then Otis is like, fuck this. I'm out of here. And he starts to turn and leave. Hank draws his weapon and is like, nah, not so fast or whatever. He says point blank, I'm going to do this the way you did Wheeler. And then Otis turns to leave again. Hank shoots him, kind of wings him,
yeah,
little
yeah.
neck, maybe shoulder action, right. but then full-blown executes him with a bullet to the back of the head.
Yep.
Of course, Peter Pryor, who was staying in Liz's shack in the back, was really looking for a reason to come into the main house.
Uh-huh.
Here's the gunshot, comes in with his gun drawn, a short standoff ensues, and then essentially Pryor chooses Danvers over his dad, right? Yeah. You have the little, oh shit, which way is he going to go moment, but... once Hank realizes what's happening, like, oh, he's not going to help me get away with this. Hank says, you should know something. I didn't kill Annie Kay. I just moved her body. Blood is blood, Peter. Remember that. And then he raises his weapon towards Danvers, like forcing his son to blow his head off. It's like suicide yeah. by cop, except little, the cop was your kid.
Kind of. Yeah, definitely. Like, and maybe... maybe he is, you know, like hanging on to this the off chance that his son can't kill him, son won't kill him. But,
maybe, but it was a kind of a slow gun raise.
It was,
like, I'm going to give you the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And even then, it's like, then what are you going to do? Because you're going to have to kill your kid too, or otherwise,
right.
he's definitely going to be like, this guy just murdered two people, so you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison probably, unless you now have the balls to kill your son as well.
Yes.
So definitely it was.
No, I think that is it, right? Like, and Danvers kept saying, like, think, Pryor. And it's almost like she's talking to both of them, right? Like, how does this play out?
Yep.
And if you go through what Barrett just did, there is no way out of this with Hank okay.
Right.
Like, the best version of this for him. And this took the whole Hank thing full circle. Because you're thinking, like, this guy's got nothing.
Yep.
That's why the Russian mail order bride storyline, he's just a sad, lonely, pathetic fucking loser who's been sucked into doing some corrupt shit because he's got nothing going for him. And at this point, he's more valuable just dying right there.
Yeah.
So that his kid can maybe go on and live a half-decent life, right?
Yeah, it was pretty, still, like, quite a climax. You know, really, really, you could feel the momentum here.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And I kept, you know, we've been on Kovic watch, we've been on Peter Pryor watch. The whole thing, like, I keep thinking about the scene from Mare of Easttown, and I won't name names in case you haven't watched that show and you want to, but there's a death, and I just kept, like, it's the type of scene that I kept waiting for, and we got pretty much, like, not shot for shot, but we got something very similar here. Somebody gets domed almost out of nowhere, and pretty shocking death.
Yeah.
Because it's not really who you think it's going to be.
Right.
Like, not that you think that Hank is going to make it till the end of the season, but, like, we've been so worried about Pete that it was an interesting flip there, I think, that Pete is actually the one that has to
pull the trigger.
To pull the trigger. And that is not something that I, definitely not something that I saw coming. So I thought this was a really, it was a great scene.
This was a great penultimate moment.
Yeah.
This is what you want.
This is what you want.
This is what you want. So, but that being said, Peter Pryor will need many, many, many years of therapy with a very good therapist.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, yeah.
Because that's not easy to recover from. So Danvers wants to call Connolly, like, just to call this in, right?
Fratricide.
That's what it is. Yeah, good old-fashioned Game of Thrones word there. but Navarro talks Danvers out of calling Connolly, saying that Connolly is in on this. He will bury every single one of them. And, I mean, to what degree, it's still kind of unclear to me. I think Connolly is just a stoolie, though. I don't think he's calling the shots. I think it's all Kate McKintrick, and he's just a cog.
She's told him, I'll
help you become mayor, right?
Yeah, probably. But I do think that he is aware of the Annie Kay cover-up.
To some degree.
I think he knows, fully knows.
That it got covered up. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
For the mine.
Because in the car scene, Hank says to Kate, he's like, why don't you take this to Connolly?
Right.
The So that
she says, like, Connelly's a political animal.
He's not, like, he's not going to do murder. He's not going to get his hands
dirty.
Yeah,
you're right.
But the fact that Hank says that she should go to Connelly with this definitely, I feel,
implies that he is in it with them.
To, yeah. You know, to a full knowledge level at the very least.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, that makes sense. So Navarro wants to stage Hank's death somewhere else and make it look like Hank snatched Otis and shot him, and then when he tried to get rid of the body, he had an accident and died. Now, how they accomplish that is going to be a whole other fucking thing that I hope they give us some of in the next episode, because, like, that is harder than it sounds.
I think that this involves two things. I think that this involves leaving the Otis body findable and then Hank's truck findable.
But not Hank's body.
But not Hank's body, yeah.
Because otherwise, they're going to be like,
there's a giant bullet wound.
Somebody blew his head off. This wasn't a fucking accident.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So Peter agrees, and he gets put on cleanup duty while Danvers and Navarro go to those caves under the cover of the storm, which apparently they need so nobody can track them. And Navarro tells Peter, you clean. You clean good.
Yeah.
Then get the bodies.
Rough line. It wasn't great.
Yeah. Then get the bodies to Rose Aganaugh. Tell her I said to take you to Julia. So this is the, just to, I know, but just to talk about it for one more second. It did make me think maybe Rose is real, because what she is asking him to do is get Rose to take him to the spot where they dumped Julia's ashes.
Right.
But wait, why? Okay, now I'm rethinking this.
To put the bodies there?
But we just talked about how the only body that... Oh, maybe that's where they put Hank's body, under the ice. Right. Like, stuff him in
just
there.
Put him in the sea.
Okay, yeah.
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 Something like that.
Never mind. She's not going to be real. She's not going to be out there. It's not going to make a difference. Hey, you sit me with these two bodies. Nobody out here. What the fuck kind of advice is that?
Big job for Pete, dude, by the way. He just had to do fratricide, and now he's got to clean up two dead bodies and get them out to a dead ghost woman. Like,
this guy.
Quite a mission.
Yeah. So just the last thing that happens, Danvers and Navarro drive out to the caves, and this, like, apparently it's a Category 4 fucking hurricane occurring. That's what Aganaugh said when her and...
Hurricane's about to blow in.
Category 4 we've got going. It's crazy windy.
Dang.
The episode closes with a creepy cover of Eagle Eye Cherry's Save Tonight, which I loved. That was great. I want to hear your general thoughts here.
Yeah. My general thought just about the episode.
What'd this one do for you?
Yeah, this was the best episode of the season for me. I thought that we finally got, like, real plot movement, real development, real character development either. It's not just that there was a big reveal or a crazy character death, but the fact that this filled in some of the blanks that I had been looking for just for the baseline of who our characters are, and I thought that was really important. And I thought it had a lot of really good stuff. I thought John Hawks finally got to do his thing, which I mentioned earlier. I thought Jodie Foster, again, like I already mentioned, I thought she kind of leaned into her role as a good guy now here at the end, like fully on the side of good and breaking against type a little bit with this, you know, curmudgeonly anti-hero asshole, you know, cop mom.
I mean, her daughter had even told her, I haven't given up on you.
Danvers,
yeah,
Liz. So all in all, really solid episode, and I think it sets them up to end this in a way that does feel interesting, good, satisfying, put whatever,
like, quality TV,
you know, qualifier you want on it. Yeah, and I think that a lot of people kind of like. There's probably three camps. You're either in your camp, who has, I think, been feeling pretty positive about this throughout. My camp, which has been more of like a wait and see, I'm not so sure. And then a camp where you're just like, you've already decided that you're not going to enjoy the show because the first three episodes had mixed results.
Which is a pretty outspoken camp.
Four episodes with mixed results.
Yeah.
And so, like, it doesn't really matter how it finishes because you've already kind of...
You made your decision.
You made the decision. So, We'll see. I'll say final judgment until I see the whole thing. I one of the other things that I was thinking about besides the Jodie Foster, like, hasn't really played a bad guy too many times thing, is that the other thing that I was thinking a lot about was some of the lines, some of the writing, is that Issa Lopez her forte is horror. It is horror. If you pull up her her Wikipedia. Most of her previous stuff has all been Spanish language, but currently Lopez is working with Guillermo del Toro, who announced that he'd produce Lopez's next film. She's got a haunted Western about the werewolf mythology. I think that is the Guillermo del Toro produced film.
Okay.
Then Searchlight Pictures signed her to write and direct The Book of Souls, which is going to be produced by Noah Hawley, who's the writer-director of Fargo television series.
Oh, sick.
And then Blumhouse, who we all know, right? Big horror film producer, is developing Our Lady of Tears, written and directed by Lopez. So I just thought that was an interesting note, because I think that probably speaks to why some of the writing, plot development, detective piece of all of this show has maybe been like
a little different, yeah,
and not up to what we typically expect, because it's not what she's typically done. That's why we get scenes like Navarro pulling clothes out of the dryer and getting like a creepy strand of hair, like,
or the straight up jump scares
slipping,
yeah,
through it, or the jump scares and the ghosts all looking like they do. Like, that's what she does. She's a horror director and writer. So not saying that like she gets a pass for that, because critiques are still her style,
inserted into it, right? But that's different than people expected.
Even lines like you clean good, like, feel like something from a Scream movie almost. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but that noir style, kind of cheesy, what some people would consider to be like bad lines, that's also just part of this show. Like, if you go watch season one, dude, some of the lines, now don't get me wrong, they hit correctly,
yeah,
but they're fucking absurd. Like, especially Rust Cole. He says some of the dumbest, most ridiculous shit you've ever heard in your life. Now, most of the lines end up hitting really, really well because McConaughey is a god. Yep. But like, that has carried through all four seasons now. And I think that was intentional. I'm not saying like maybe they played out the way that she had hoped on, yep, screen, but I do think there are some of those cheesy True Detective lines are sort of like a trademark of the show. And she very, very clearly, Issa Lopez, was a huge fan of this show.
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
I think that's the reason she took on the project. Yep. And like, she's done all this homage to season one kind of throughout her season of being the showrunner, right? Which you have to assume is the only one she'll get. So she really wanted to make the point to like carry some of these stylistic elements. And it just, yeah, I mean, sorry, I wasn't trying to jump on your rant there, but like, yeah, no, that hasn't, like, I haven't been like, ah, this is shit, yeah, writing wise.
It's more so just to think fully through the fact that, like,
yeah,
she had Night Country in her pocket to some degree, then turned it into a True Detective story.
Yeah.
So like, she, like, the horror writer and director probably wrote Night Country being very much like a horror thriller show, and then got the chance to turn it into Night Country and kind of had to add more detective mystery noir stuff to it.
Yeah.
And that's some of the stuff, like Kovic just showing up with his boy Kenny and being like, that's the spiral from Night Country. Because, like, they had to work in the spiral. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
Kenny, Taylor. Taylor, what your grandma told you, Kenny.
Yeah, so some of that stuff that is just, like, a little on the nose or cheesy feeling or feeling shoehorned in is because it was shoehorned in.
Yes. No, I totally understand what you're saying.
So I still just, it just leaves me wondering, again, kind of to piggyback off a question that I asked you last week, what this show would have looked like if it had just been Issa Lopez's Night Country, no further titling.
I think we'll always have that question, yeah, now, right? Because I do think there was a give and take here. And my guess is everything you just described is the reason that throughout the season you've been like, what is rubbing me, yeah, the wrong way? You know what I mean? And it's because, like, it's kind of this, like, montage, collaboration,
right,
like a stained glass window of style. Yeah. Like, there's, like, yeah, you know, elements that she probably had written already.
Right.
Then elements that she shoehorned in when it became True Detective. Then there's the horror stuff that is clearly her forte.
Yeah.
But you can't do that the whole time because that's not what this is supposed to be.
Right. Yep.
And so there is, I definitely understand what you're saying. And to a certain extent, I have felt some of those bumps, like turbulence along, yeah, the way, where I'm like, what are we doing? This is wild. But I did have, look, and just to be frank, it's not all my radar here. It's not just my ability to, like, know that we're going in a good direction. My read was that the all of this positive critical response that we were getting from people who had the screeners, who had watched the whole season, wouldn't really make sense if those first three, four episodes didn't turn into a really good story. So, like, I felt confident for that reason, too. Also, six-part series, dude, I'm just not going to jump to conclusions until it's fucking time, which now it is time. Like, during the penultimate episode and the finale, that's when you can really judge. And, like, I thought this was very good. I mean, this did what I wanted it to do. Put us in a position where we've gotten some answers. We've gotten some. I still don't think we're going to get nearly as many as we would like, right? I don't think the Tuttle shit will get explained. I don't think... I don't even know if they're going to explain... The scientist stuff. We're going out to the caves to solve Annie K's crime. I don't think it's going to fucking explain what happened to those guys, too, right? Like, that would be... But maybe they pull something crazy off that somehow wraps it all up nicely. Or not all of it, but at least those two main crimes.
Yeah, it's a good question.
We'll see. But you have to feel... I feel good about where we're going, heading out into Night Country, into the caves, where we thought the finale would be, right? That's going to be our Carcosa, you got to assume.
We already know we've got 80 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And we're at the caves. They're driving to the caves. So that's... We should start at the caves, theoretically.
Yeah, we're going to see some shit.
You know, so...
This upcoming Sunday, dude. Like, we all know that.
Yeah.
You got to imagine the horror element gets brought back pretty heavily for the finale. You got Peter Pryor over here going to visit a woman who may or may not exist. You got to think. Because remember, Danvers and Navarro are not even supposed to be on this case anymore. So you got to think, like, Connolly and Kate McKintick or whatever.
McKintrick.
I hate her last name. That they're going to be trying to... stop this somehow, right? Or something. And God knows what the fuck is going to happen out there. I really have no idea. Last thing I'll ask. You see Danvers and Navarro surviving this thing?
Yes.
Really? I think Danvers is a goner. I think she's a goner. Leah goes to live with the Pryors. You know? Wouldn't that be a nice little, you know?
Don't know how great that household is.
Well, that's fair. Peter's going to be dealing with some serious trauma after the whole fratricide thing.
I think...
But he's not living there right now, so...
Yeah, I'm placing my bet that Danvers and Navarro both survive. Yeah.
I'm thinking back. I think the only season where all of our true detectives don't survive is two.
Yep.
Yeah. Three, they both survive. One, they both survive. Yeah. Anyway, Barrett and I will be back on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles later this week to further digest and discuss part four, up through part five, excuse me, of True Detective Night Country with help from the Mollusk Militia in the form of hotline calls. Go to patreon.com/oystersclamscockles if you want to hear more. There was a lot in this one to pick apart and further discuss. I'm really looking forward to Patreon this week. patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. Go support the show. Get in there in exchange for more. Follow us on social media everywhere. Just search Oysters, Clams, Cockles on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter. We're on all the platforms to watch our show instead of just listening to it. No offense to those of you who love listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. But some people do enjoy watching more, and we're on youtube.com/oystersclamscockles, youtube.com/@oystersclamscockles is, I guess, the official URL, where you can go watch full episodes of our show in addition to short clips in the form of YouTube Shorts. Go subscribe today. Mr. Dudley, where can the people follow you to keep up with everything else you do?
At Barrett Dudley on Instagram.
It's the gram. I'm at WR Bolin on Instagram and Twitter, or X, formerly known as Twitter. Go to bolinmedia.com/shop to grab yourself some merch. Thanks for supporting our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being here today. Thank you for watching with us. One more episode. Remember... we're all in the Night Country now.